his eyes cast down, as if he was looking at a tobacco leaf covered with a breed of worm he'd never seen before. I thought about Mustard, all alone, the only brave voice, the rest of us sitting like eggs, just waiting. "It's not about the notch or the tree," I whispered.
"What did you say, Nina Huff?"
Ben asked sharply.
"It's not about the notch or the tree either," I said louder. "It's about claiming something that doesn't belong to you." I couldn't tell whether I was getting us into trouble or getting us out of it, but it was a huge chore, no matter what it was, and my voice shook. "It's like if we told Grandpa Herman that we deserve to be paid for picking up leaves in the field, when the field doesn't really belong to us at all, and he already takes care of our needs."
"Yes," Ben sighed. "Thank you, Nina." But I knew my explanation wasn't quite right. Mustard looked at me like he couldn't believe what I'd said, and then Ben attacked him directly.
"And you will understand one day, too," he said to Mustard, "if you listen instead of speaking."
For the rest of that night at church, we all recited obediently, and nobody else spoke out. But my ears were still hot, burning almost as fiercely as the inside of my chest, like nettles, and the whole time I prayed quietly that Mustard wouldn't have to spend the night in a grave to contemplate the wages of sin, prayed that I wouldn't. Later that year, when the men loaded up bundles of tobacco on big-ton trucks and hauled them off to the warehouse to be auctioned, when school started again, and I climbed on the bus and found myself 20 miles away at a big school where 7th, 8th, and 9th graders teemed through the halls like ants, and I couldn't pick out another Fire and Brimstone anywhere. Later that year, I had a change for the worse. It started with the bleeding. I wouldn't have known what it was, except that they showed us a film at school, and Nana had mentioned it to me once, briefly. I still didn't want anyone to know. I hid my underpants in a box that first month, pair after pair, until I was forced to sneak into Pammy's house and steal some of hers, the lining so white it made me cry. Then there was my hair, so heavy that it hurt my neck to carry it, so heavy that when I leaned my head over the side of the tub on Saturdays to wash it, I couldn't pick my head back up until Mama lifted it and squeezed the water out.
"Her head stinks,"
the girl sitting behind me in social studies would whisper to the girl to her left.
"Why doesn't she wash it?"
And I'd turn around to see them waving their hands in front of their noses and smiling conspiratorially, but not at me. When I washed my hair on Saturday, it was still wet on Sunday, and if it was braided, it didn't dry until Sunday night. Then there was the problem with my chest, my nipples behaving like somebody had scared them, trying to crawl back inside of me just when everybody else's were showing off. It wasn't easy to undress for gym in front of all those girls who had bras. I couldn't do gym in a dress. I couldn't tell Mama or Daddy, because if they knew the school issued us shorts and t-shirts, they'd call up and make a scene. James had already warned me not to. In the few years since the school had required dressing out for gym class, the handful of Fire and Brimstone children had kept the secret. It was our only chance to prove that we had legs. That was the year that Everett married Wanda, and they moved behind us into a cinder block house between David and Laura's and Bethany and Olin's. I was the only child at home then, living in the house behind Grandpa and Nana's. To the right of Grandpa and Nana's, 9 other houses filled with Fire and Brimstone relatives sat in a field like great mushrooms. All the houses were gray, and mostly they looked just alike. But to the left of Grandpa Herman's house, in the next field, The church emerged from the ground like a peasant's castle. All I had to do was stand on the doorsteps, and I could yell out to anyone at all. If I filled my lungs enough and imagined them the color of Jesus's blood, I could call out so loudly, so clearly, that even the third cousins on the other side of the compound might hear. But it wasn't the same, being the only child in the house. It didn't matter that we were always together, or that when I leaned out my bedroom window, I could see inside the other houses, the land all around us, the two new houses being built, the fire and brimstone fields. It didn't really help that I could see the barns, the pig pen, the chicken coop, the silo where we kept the grains, and beyond, all the woods that belonged to us too. It wasn't enough to make up for the lonely. I miss the days when I was small enough to climb into bed with Mama and Daddy and stretch out on Daddy's belly, tapping out rhythms on his shiny front teeth, while Mama played my back like a drum and we all sang together. Evenings when Mama and Daddy sat out on the doorsteps talking to David and Laura, who were expecting a child that next March. When I knew I was inside alone, I crept into their bedroom, pulled back a blanket, and buried my face in their sheets, sniffing for something that would fill me up. At Fire and Brimstone, we all looked alike, and that made me lonely, too. We didn't all have the same color eyes or the same textured hair, but it really didn't matter. Our shadows came in two varieties, male and female. We were all lanky. We all dressed alike. We slept in the same hard beds and washed with soaps made from the same iron pot. All the men wore beards clipped close and work boots that left the same muddy tracks. All the women pulled their hair into buns and left their faces bare for the sun to adorn as it would. We may as well have been skeletons, unidentifiable. We may as well have interchanged our bones. I used to pray that God would stunt my growth and keep me little, so at least my frame wouldn't be confused with anyone else's. Pammy was the relative closest to my size, and as we grew towards being lost in bodies all the same, I'd do my best to make my shadow different, even from hers. Afternoons as we marched through fields, I'd study our shapes bruised on the ground and pull myself up taller, or fling out my arms to keep from getting confused about which shape belonged to her and which shape belonged to me. It was the middle of October when David knocked at our door before daylight. I heard him downstairs, crying to Daddy about how Laura's unborn baby was demanding to get out. By the time I was dressed, Mama and Nana, Bethany and Wanda, the aunts and women cousins all sat in the living room inside David and Laura's house, praying and drinking hot water with honey. Laura was in bed. Nana made her keep her feet up, forbid her to even stand to go to the bathroom. Pammy and I peeked in from the windows, listening to the whispered words like spotting, and watching Nana remove soiled towels from between Laura's legs, watching Laura crying until Mama crawled into bed beside her and held her head. We crouched down in the bushes, and Pammy, who had a face like Grandpa Herman's, speckled as a trout, asked, "Will it die?" "Yeah, it will die," I snapped at her. "If it comes out now, it probably won't even have lungs yet. It won't be able to breathe."
"But God's wind's almighty," Pammy insisted. "It won't die if God doesn't let it."
"Even God won't be able to help it if it don't have lungs," I whispered back.
"Yes, he will," Pammy sniffed. "God can do anything."
And she stomped off, leaving me sitting behind the bush alone. Pammy and I were in charge of the chicken coop. It was time for us to get the eggs, only an hour before the bus would come to pick us up and take us away for the day. I hurried to join her, running down the dirt road and feeling the morning air hit at my bare legs in the places where my socks had already slipped down. By the time I caught up, Pammy was crying hard, and she looked at me and yelled, "You don't have no faith!"
"I do, too," I said. We fed the chickens. She threw them the corn, and I threw them the laying mash that we kept in metal trash cans beneath an oak tree. While they were eating, we entered the lopsided doorway of their dark old pen that smelled hot and like a secret, no matter how cold it was outside. We walked around opposite walls, lifting the eggs from the nests, wiping the ones streaked in manure onto the straw, and placing them in our baskets. Above us on the rafters, one old hen who had missed the breakfast call squawked out, scaring us both, and fluttered awkwardly down to the ground. Pammy jumped, and I hollered. The chicken ran out through the door, out into the sunlight. I laughed to see Pammy jump, and she laughed to hear me holler, and we forgot, for a minute, about David and Laura's baby. On the way back to the houses, we were chattering and laughing about the big red hen, and then we remembered. Passing by the barn, we picked up Mustard and James and our second cousins John and Barley, who'd been feeding the pigs.
"Wonder what Laura did?" Barley asked us.
"What do you mean?" I said.
"Grandpa Herman said she'd sinned. Said unconfessed sin was what made that new baby want to leave."
"That's not true," I hissed.
"That's what Grandpa Herman said," John insisted.
Hardly any women were at breakfast at all, just Aunt Kate and Aunt Velma, who had cooked. Even the good mornings were somber, and we picked up our toast, eggs, and ham off the serving line, carrying it to the table without saying a word. Most of the men were there, and midway through breakfast, Pammy called out, "Where's Grandpa Liston?" I hadn't seen my daddy since early. I didn't know where he could be.
"He's at the barn," Ben Harback answered, then paused to finish chewing what was already in his mouth. "Working on that baby's crib."
Nobody said a thing. I didn't look up, but if I had, I know I would have seen the other men giving him glances full of fury. It wasn't the kind of thing he should have said out loud. Ben Harback had come into the congregation several years earlier and claimed the beliefs almost as though he'd made them up himself. But he wasn't family, and he didn't know the unspoken rules, the ones you couldn't find in Grandpa Herman's booklet. He didn't know that when other people are in pain, you don't talk about it. You let them feel what they're feeling in private. You leave them alone. Just before the bus came, I ran into David and Laura's house to kiss Mama goodbye. She was in the room with Laura, and Bethany wouldn't get her for me.
"She'll be here when you get back," Bethany said.
"Will Laura be okay?" I asked her.
"She'll be fine,"
Bethany assured me, and shooed me out. On the bus that morning, I sat with James. I had the seat facing the window, though, and I didn't look his way. I stared out through the fogged-up glass, watching fire and brimstone get smaller and smaller, and trying to talk myself out of choking on something big and angry in my throat. When we got home from school that day, Nana was the one who gave us the news that Laura wouldn't be having a baby and wouldn't be feeling like talking for a time. David was with her, but everyone else was in the cemetery behind the church where they were laying it to rest. James asked if the children could go to the burial, and Nana said yes. I watched them all take off running with their books, their black shoes kicking up dirt behind them. "I don't have to go, do I?" I asked Nana.
"Won't bother me if you stay here. You can help me cut up taters."
I told Nana I needed to do something first, and she didn't ask any questions. I dropped my books on the doorsteps and ran the other way, towards the barn, to the place where Daddy'd been building the crib. I swung open the barn door and slipped inside to the very back where the saws and lumber and tools were kept.
The crib was finished, small and perfect, sturdy legs and sanded boards, low so that Laura, who was short, could easily reach in. He'd even carved a swirly design onto the headboard. And while I was sad about the baby that wouldn't be, I might have felt the most sadness for Daddy. When I got back to the house, Nana was standing outside listening. There were raised voices coming up from the cemetery, almost like yelling. It didn't sound like preaching, though. It sounded strange and uneven. I took her hand and we hurried to the burial site where Daddy was crying out, shaking his fist at Grandpa Herman and saying, "Don't you ever say a thing like that again."
"Listen, those aren't my words. They're God's words. The wages of sin is death,"
Grandpa Herman said calmly. A few people in the midst nodded their heads in agreement, but Daddy shouted out again, "That's not what God meant!" And he stormed away, Mama hurrying to hold on to him, hugging herself into his side against the cold. Nobody talked much about Laura and David's loss, but everybody grieved it, I guess. Even old Grandpa Herman finally kept his nasty opinions to himself, and the community healed over, quietly, with nobody picking at scabs. But sometimes things hide beneath healed-up places. Flies lay eggs inside the gashes on cows and kittens, and then the wounds swell up, even after they're closed over. And unless somebody opens the wound again to release the worm, the thing inside keeps growing and burrowing its way out, painfully, blindly, persistently. Maybe that's what happened to me. Even 2 weeks later in church, when Laura caught the spirit, stood up, began dancing around, chattering out a prayer that changed into a language nobody knew, even seeing her recovered and filled with God's strangeness, I hurt inside. It felt like something was trying to come out, something starving. I was sitting between Nana and James when it happened. Too old to eat candy in church, and too young not to wish for it. In front of me, Daddy was calling out his prayers and Mama was crying again, her hands held up as if she thought God was going to fill them with kisses. Nana kept her face straight ahead, pretending to listen, though I suspected that in her mind she was retelling old stories in new ways. Beside me, James scraped the dirt from beneath his fingernails and flicked it onto the floor. I looked at his hands, almost as big as a man's, with his fingers widening at the tips like spatulas. I felt the way you feel sometimes right before you go to sleep, when all you want to do is sleep, and then suddenly, when you're almost there, when your mind goes dizzy and it's almost like you don't have a body at all, you remember how long the night is, how you might not wake back up. And like a shock, you're sitting straight up, scared to do the thing you've done every day of your life. And Laura began wailing out, stood up, and the congregation urged her on, their voices growing like mudslides. She shook and cried, her syllables tripping over themselves until she wasn't saying anything we knew, and the words she said sounded hard, and maybe like curses in other languages.
"Praise be," Grandpa Herman yelled.
"Forgive me, Lord,"
I could hear my daddy saying. His back in front of me curled like an apostrophe, the bolts of his spine threatening his skin, and his head leaned against the next pew.
"Forgive me for doubting your holy and righteous word." "Thank you for your strength, my king," David called.
"Without you, I would be nothing,"
Laura chanted.
"Without you, O heavenly prince, I would be lower than the Olaba Hebamashundi Wea Komo Dikam Latikalama Hebamashundi."
And as she spoke, her voice went higher and higher, and her breathing got stronger. And then she was panting and squealing, crying,
"Help me remember thy awesome and bewitcha Walababeya Komo Hebamashundi."
and I was embarrassed. Embarrassed to be hearing her voice, stretching up like violin strings, tighter and louder and screeching and punctuated with her frantic breathing. Embarrassed to know what her tongue must be doing inside her mouth, rolling all over itself like it couldn't help it. It sounded like something she should do somewhere else, not in church. And I was embarrassed to be sitting next to James, hearing it all, though we'd heard it all our lives. And I was embarrassed because Laura wasn't even 10 years older than me, not even 8 years older, and I didn't want that to happen to me. Not ever. And I was embarrassed that God had never shared with me his language, had never given me special words, his almighty baptizing wind. And I was embarrassed to think that I might find it in some other place. Sometimes, if we'd finished our chores and there was still a little bit of daytime left, the children could get permission to go horseback riding. We rode two or three to a horse, even though there were usually enough horses to go around. It was easier to talk that way. One afternoon we were out in the woods, with me and Mustard and James on one horse, and Barley and Pammy and John on the other. It seemed like the girls always got sandwiched between the boys. And that day, I was protected by Mustard from the front and James from the back. We'd already crossed the creek and had ridden to a hilly place with trees on either side, so that I had to keep ducking to avoid being swatted by the tiniest branches. We'd gone farther on the horses than we usually went, and I was secretly hoping we'd end up at the pond, where the boys went swimming sometimes, but the girls were only allowed at baptisms, since the water was rumored to be dangerous. I was hoping I'd get to explore. "Let's take them to the top and run down fast," Barley called, and buried his heels in his horse's sides to make him go. "Don't do it, Mustard," James warned from behind me. But Mustard kicked the mare we were riding too, and she took off unexpectedly, making me hold tight onto Mustard, who was holding the reins, and making James grab onto me like I was sturdy as a pine, even though I wasn't. When I shifted back, I was closer than I'd ever been to sitting in his lap, and after I'd gotten used to the feeling of traveling steep uphill, I kind of liked the new sensation of his nearness. I tried to tell myself that it was no different from sitting next to him in church, but it was different. "Mustard, don't do it. The ground's too uneven," James hollered in my ear as we got closer to the top, and I yelled, "Ouch!" even though his voice didn't bother me at all. "It won't hurt them," Mustard said. "Hang on." "Nina, tell him to stop," James demanded, like I could make him listen. But I didn't want him to stop. It wasn't that I wanted the horse to get hurt. I just didn't want to shift directions. I was too busy trying to memorize the way James's legs felt around my backside, hanging on, the way his arms felt buckled around my middle. I'd already forgotten about wanting to go to the pond. From the top of the hill, Barley hollered out, and Pammy did, and John squealed as they held onto the galloping horse. We stopped and watched them soaring downwards, the horse's brown tail flicking as his front feet pounded the ground, then his back feet. Then the horse stumbled over a hole, and all I could see was a tumbling of bodies, somersaulting clothes, and Pammy's red hair. But the horse neighed out, got up, and kept running. It was Pammy who grabbed his tail, and then we were watching her being pulled behind him, with Barley running hard to catch up and grab the reins. It looked like the horse's back hooves were kicking Pammy in the belly, even though later she said they weren't. John was crying, so Mustard began walking our mare slowly down the slope. We could still hear Barley yelling, "Whoa, boy, whoa!" in the distance. "Be careful," I warned Mustard. "But hurry up," James said. "You got to get him. I told you it was a bad idea." Then we were down from our horse and checking on John. "You okay?" I asked him. But he just moaned, and showed us his scraped hands.
"Stop being a crybaby," Mustard yelled. "We gotta catch up with Barley and Pammy."
"Leave him alone," James screamed. "Go on ahead." So Mustard climbed back on the mare and went trotting off.
"Come on, John," I said.
John was a whiner, and I knew he probably wasn't hurt at all. Probably not nearly so hurt as Pammy, anyway. I didn't offer John my hand, but James gave him his. He helped him up and led the three of us through the ravine, and even though my thinking about John was more along the lines of Mustard's, I didn't say so. Not after seeing the way James was treating him. On the far side of the creek, we met up with the others. Mustard was still on horseback, but Pammy was rubbing the fallen horse's head, and Barley was petting her neck. They were all laughing nervously.
"Don't you ever do that again," James scolded.
"It was kind of fun,"
Pammy said, but she was muddy, and I could see that her legs were shaking.
"Nobody got hurt," Barley laughed.
"John got hurt," James said.
And on the way back to the barn, we shifted positions on the horse. James held the reins, even though Mustard protested. I still sat in the middle, wishing there was some way we could go downhill so I'd have a reason to lean against him again. Late fall and winter, when the crops were in, the men of our community took jobs laying bricks, building houses, painting, or reupholstering furniture. Fire and Brimstone men had a good reputation as strong workers, who did twice what other men did during the day. They never went to work drunk or took a whole hour for lunch or knocked off early, so even Methodists or people without faith would hire them for the winter months. But Saturdays were for hunting. Before day, the men would rise, eat together, and head out to the woods, to the hundreds of uncut acres Fire and Brimstone owned. They'd take their dogs and guns and ride away in pickups, dropping off a man at every tree with a stand built into it, a crude treehouse where each man would sit and think about God while waiting for the dogs to run a deer down below. Even the boys got to go. To me, deer driving was one of the most mysterious habits of our community. I woke up early every Saturday, too, looked out the window to see Mustard and James walking out with Olin, to see Barley leaving his house with his father, and John, who was younger and only had a BB gun, running to catch up. They'd laugh, and puffs of smoke would appear in the cold air. They'd pat each other hard on the back and make their way into Grandpa Herman's house, stomping their boots on the steps. He'd hold the door for them all, welcoming them so happily with his forbidden denture smile. I wanted to go with them worse than anything. Saturdays were expectant days. We listened for the shotgun blast, wondering who had fired, wondering if they'd killed a deer or planted another shell into the land, wondering how long it would be before the truck pulled up, a deer in the back, limp as a mop. For the women, Saturdays were cleaning days, days for washing our clothes and our bodies, our floors and our windows. All we had to do on Saturday was wash and wait for the men. One Saturday in November, when the floors were already done, Mama sent me out to the woodpile to collect a few pieces of firewood. I was on my way back into the house when I heard the pickups come bumping down the road. Mustard was in the back of the first truck, his red hair hidden beneath a knit hat, but his red ears poking out obscenely.
"James killed one," he hollered, "and they're getting ready to bloody him."
"James killed it," I yelled inside to Mama. "Come on."
"Oh, good," she called back excited. "I'm getting my coat."
It was James's first deer. And whenever a man killed a deer for the first time, the other hunters collected the blood and entrails and poured them over his head. It was a family tradition, a rite of passage, and a man's special bath all rolled into one. My daddy had built a place to skin and clean a deer just off the side of our house. He'd hung a noose of sorts from the rafters in the beams of the garage, and that's where they tied the deer up, upside down, so they could rip it from top to bottom, and the head would hang low so they could saw it off more easily. When we got there, James was beaming. Olin ruffled his dark hair, and Bethany put her arm around him. The women were coming from other houses, and the last of the pickups were pulling into the yard. But when they pulled the deer out, it was a doe. I knew we had a law against killing female deer, and couldn't understand why everybody was so jubilant. Grandpa Herman kept saying, "That was a good shot, son." And James kept grinning, saying things like, "I just looked down and there she was, walking behind the blackberry bush." I shuffled back to Nana while they hung the deer up. "It's a doe," I whispered to her. "He won't kill a doe again," Nana assured me. "It's his first deer," she added, as if that explained it. I tried to remember whether other men had been allowed to kill a doe their first time. I figured they must have. But I'd never paid attention. It hadn't seemed to matter before that day. "You got anything to catch the blood in, Liston?" Olin asked, and Daddy told me to fetch a 5-gallon bucket. We had one just outside the back door to catch rainwater, and I dumped the sludge out of the bottom and raced back. By the time I returned, Everett and Olin had pulled the deer's legs apart, and Daddy had his knife stuck high in the deer's crotch. He was standing to the side, and as I placed the bucket beneath the deer, he pulled his sharp knife downward. I should have moved, but I couldn't stop watching him open her up that way. About the time he reached the ribcage, the stomach and blood splashed out and into the bucket, stewed like vomit. I wasn't expecting it to come so forcefully, so soon, and I got caught in the spray. I jumped back, but not in time to spare my face, my dress, or my shoes. Ben Harback started laughing, and everyone looked at me. I found myself standing there, speckled with her blood, and with my arms held out to my side as if I didn't want my hands to touch myself. "Child," my mama said, "don't you have sense enough to know not to stand that close?" But then she was laughing too. Everyone was. I backed out of the way, back to Nana, who shook her head at me and slapped my bottom playfully. I looked down at my white socks, all soiled. "I'll have to do another load anyway," she said. "James's clothes will be a lot worse than yours." Then we stood together and watched David pick up the bucket. James tried to run at first, half playing but half serious. Grandpa Herman caught him and told him to take it like a man, and then James walked into the circle, and David dumped the hot blood over his head. Everybody clapped for him. Nobody clapped as hard as Grandpa Herman. Drops fell from James's earlobes, trickled along his nose. He spit and wiped his eyes. While they were cutting the deer up, I changed clothes and took the bloody ones over to Nana's. I took my underwear to her, too. All those pairs I'd kept in the box. I stuffed them in the pockets of my dress, and she washed them with James's clothes. That night the men cooked venison outside on the gas stove. It was cut up into small chunks and fried tender, but I couldn't eat it. Not that time. Even though it was James's first deer, I couldn't eat her. That night, Nana returned my clothes to me, and all my underwear was clean and folded up neatly inside my dress. I could still see the stains on them, though. They weren't white like Pammy's. They were dingy, like the bottom of a sock. James and Mustard and John and Barley had set out traps to catch raccoons and squirrels and anything else that happened to fall prey. Though the next day was Sunday, The boys were allowed to go check their traps after church and after we'd eaten.
"Can I go with them?"
I asked Mama.
"Them woods ain't no place for a girl," she said.
"Please, Mama," I begged. "I've finished all my homework."
"Let her go, Marie. Ain't no reason why she can't run along with them," Aunt Kate said.
"Ask your daddy," Mama told me. They were getting ready to leave already, and I told them to wait for me. Barley moaned about it, but they waited. Daddy was outside with the men, picking his teeth with a stick he'd whittled down and slapping his knee over a joke somebody had told.
"Can I go, Daddy?"
I whispered in his ear.
"I really want to, and Mama said I could if you didn't mind."
"I don't care," he told me. "Don't be gone long."
So I hustled off with the boys before Pammy found out and wanted to come too.
"Girls can't hunt," John mocked.
"Well, you can't either," I claimed. "Not with just a little BB gun."
"I killed a bird with it," he said. "Killed 2 birds. And I'm getting me a gun for my birthday. You wait and see."
"Even when you get a gun, you won't be able to shoot it," Barley picked. "When you pull that trigger, it'll kick back so hard your shoulder will be bruised for a week."
"Well, your shoulder bruises too," John whined.
We walked past the barn, and James stopped to stroke a mare's long nose. We walked past the pig pen, and past the chicken coop, and all the way back to the place where the field ended and the woods began.
"Where'd we put that first trap?" Mustard asked. "Weren't it right in there?"
And pointed back down a path.
"Yeah, that's it," Barley agreed. "You all go on in there and walk up the creek. I'll take Nina with me and we'll check the traps from the other side and meet you in the middle," James said. "I want to show her where I killed my deer."
"Why do you want to show her?"
John ridiculed.
"Because she ain't seen it yet, and you have," James said.
"All right,"
Mustard conceded, and the 3 younger boys disappeared behind branches and brush. James led me in another direction.
"It's kind of growed up in here," he said,
holding back limbs so they wouldn't slap me. We walked for a long time, with him leading the way and me following, stepping over briars and over moss. As I crunched across lichen and then headed down near the creek through mud, I felt something churning in my chest, like too much sorrow. I didn't want to follow James to a place I hadn't seen. I wanted to be the one showing him something. I didn't want to be the girl. We found a place to cross the creek where a tree grew in the middle, and we could step onto a root and then over to the other side. James offered me his hand, but I didn't take it.
"Not far now,"
he said after a while, and I watched his flannel shirt stretch tight across his back. I watched his dark hair curling up around his collar. He'd need a haircut soon. I followed his dark pants into the woods, deeper and deeper.
"You tired?"
he asked me, looking back.
"No,"
I insisted.
"Well, why ain't you talking to me?"
he asked.
"You mad?"
I shrugged.
"Why are you mad?"
He stopped, and I stopped too, not wanting to get one bit closer.
"'Cause you killed a doe," I said. "And she could have had 10 baby boys for you to kill later. But now she can't, because she's dead."
"They told me to," James argued. "They said, shoot anything that comes your way."
"It's the first one," he explained. "That rule don't apply to your first one."
"Well, it should," I fussed. "You shouldn't never kill a doe."
I was holding onto a skinny tree, shaking it in my hand. When I looked up at James again, I was surprised to see him so silenced. He didn't look like a big boy at all then. He looked little in his eyes.
"Want me to take you back?"
he offered.
"No,"
I said.
"You sure?"
"I want to see it," I told him.
I want to see the place where you killed her." He took my hand and led me through the woods into a clearing. On the other side there was a tree with a stand in it. "You were up there?" I asked him.
"Yeah."
So I walked over to the place where the little slats of board were nailed to the tree trunk and began climbing up. When I was sitting on the narrow plank, with James right beside me, I said, "Show me where she was." He pointed to a cluster of bushes over to the right.
"She was right there," he said, "with her head down. And you see them branches over there? Not in that first bush, but the one behind it."
I nodded.
"Well, I thought they were a rack," he explained. "I thought she was a buck. Otherwise I wouldn't have shot at her, no matter what anybody said."
"Oh," I sighed, and looked into my lap, feeling like I might cry and hating myself for it. I told myself I should be relieved or even happy that James hadn't meant to kill a doe. But I was crying anyway. I didn't want James to see.
"Nina?" he whispered. "Nina?"
And when I looked at his face, all I saw were his lips, chapped and damp, his mouth open just a little, and his chipped tooth right in front from the day we were playing in the pack house and he tripped on the stairs. I stared at his mouth until I had to close my eyes from the nearness of it, from the feeling of those chapped lips on the skin above my eyes. I was sitting in the porch swing beside Nana, bundled up in a blanket. Nana didn't have a blanket of her own, but the end of my blanket stretched across her legs, so she wasn't too cold. Pammy and Bethany sat outside with us for a while, watching the moon hover low in the clouds, the sky still streaked with hints of day. Bethany brushed out Pammy's hair, then braided it back neatly in spite of Pammy's protests. But then Pammy got whiny and wanted to go inside, so Bethany kissed Nana goodnight, and they left.
"You need to get home and do your lessons," Nana said.
"Don't have anything except a math quiz that I already studied for."
"When did you study?" she asked me.
"On the bus."
"That don't count," she said. "All that noise. You need to study it again."
"I'll go in a minute," I promised. Nana rubbed at my sock, pressed her bony thumb into my arch, and moved it around and around beneath the blanket. "Tell me the story of when you met Grandpa Herman," I begged her. What I really wanted to hear about was the first time they kissed, but I knew that story was off limits.
"Why do you want to hear that? I've told you 100 times. Nobody else nags at me for stories."
"I like your stories," I said. "Tell me." Nana patted my foot, put it down, and picked up the other one, pressing into my heel.
"I was just about your size," she began, "and stupider than a sunflower in the shade. And Herman came a-courtin', dressed in brand-new denim breeches and a starched white shirt, walked right up to Uncle Ernie's door, carrying a handful of ragged azalea flowers he'd cut off his mama's bush with his pocket-knife.
Was he grinning at you and winking?" I smiled at her, and she smiled back and said,
"You've done heard this story, and I ain't telling it again tonight when you've got lessons to get. But don't think I don't know what's in your head, girl. I can see it in your eyes."
"Ma'am?" I asked her innocently.
"You're James's aunt, whether you like it or not, and he's your nephew, whether you like it or not. I can see you two looking at each other, and you better be careful, is all I got to say, because you're gonna get hurt if you ain't careful."
"I ain't really his aunt," I said.
"Not by blood, maybe, but by position. So you can forget that right now, do you hear me?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Now get on home and study for that math test."
"It's just a quiz,"
I reminded her. Study, she repeated. When I got home, Everett and Wanda were sitting on the couch, talking to Mama and Daddy. I could tell that Wanda had been crying. Her eyes looked like pictures of boxers I'd seen, without the bruises. She and Everett were sitting close, though, so I knew that the problem wasn't between them. Daddy motioned me to his lap, and I sat down there with him in his chair, my skinny legs almost as long as his. I sat in Daddy's lap all the time, big as I was by then. But that day was the first time I paid attention to what his knees felt like against the backs of my thighs. I imagined what it would feel like to sit on James's lap, and then whispered a little prayer for forgiveness. Honey, Daddy said to Wanda, it's just going to take some getting used to.
But I miss them so bad, though, Wanda stammered.
She was fatter than the rest of us, but she'd only been living at Fire and Brimstone for a couple of months.
I just don't understand why I can't go see them.
Nobody's saying you can't see them, Mama interjected. Go if you want to. But you know that the minute you step foot in their house, you'll be breathing the air of their sinfulness.
I know, she whimpered. It's not that I don't like it here.
And she buried her face in Everett's shirt. Everett looked at us while she cried. Everett had a lot of muscles, and the muscles in his face were begging. Wanda, Mama said, you got to pull yourself together. She looked up with her face all red and ugly and said,
I miss their bad manners and their jokes. I miss their drinking and fighting. I even miss laying in the bed on Sunday mornings and listening to Daddy snoring down the hall. I know it's a sin to wish for those things. I know it is.
What you have to do, Daddy told her, is try to feel the way Jesus felt, dying on that cross for our sins. You have to think of your life as an example like Jesus's, because one day your sinful people might look at you and see that they can step right off the broad road to destruction and onto the narrow path to righteousness, just like you've done.
I pray about it, Wanda said.
And we pray about it, too, Everett assured her. We pray for your family every day, just like you do. And don't that make us a stronger family here, joining our hearts in prayer?
Yeah.
She tried to smile. Daddy scratched my back while they talked. I bit my bottom lip and shamefully pretended his fingers belonged to James. Mama got out of her chair and went over to the couch and sat down on the other side of Wanda.
I know I can't be your mother, child, she said. You've done got a mother of your own, and maybe one day, through your example, she'll see the state of her heart. But I want you to know that I'll be everything for you that I can.
And then Wanda leaned over and cried on Mama for a while. Daddy winked at Everett to reassure him, and I saw that Daddy's eyes had tears in them, too.
Where you been, Peanut? Everett asked me, trying to keep his voice steady and change the subject at the same time.
On the porch with Nana, I told him.
Can you believe how this girl's growing? Daddy asked him. Bet she shot up 3 inches this year.
She's about old enough to go out on dates, Wanda sniffed.
And Everett passed her his handkerchief.
Not my baby, Daddy said.
I don't want to go on a date, I said.
Not till she's 18, Mama teased, because most everybody in our community was married by 17 or 18. And then she can only take a date to church.
Later that night, before Wanda and Everett left, Mama suggested that whenever Wanda got homesick, she should pinch herself with clothespins for distraction.
Physical discomfort is one of the best ways to keep your mind on heaven, Daddy agreed.
That night, I carried a handful of clothespins to bed with me,
since my mind was on everything but heaven. I clamped them to the skin on the inside of my arms and on my stomach. I saved two for my nipples, and those hurt almost too much to bear. That night I prayed that God would guide me, would help me forget about James's mouth and his hands that I couldn't stop imagining. I prayed that God would cleanse me with a dose of Jesus's pain and keep my body clean and sacred just for him. And when I couldn't keep my mind on Jesus, I told myself the story of Nana and Grandpa to keep from remembering the way kisses felt. Leela watched him from the window of the bedroom she shared with her cousin Imogen. Herman Langston, spiffed up and brave, walking towards the back door. Whenever she thought he might look her way, she'd duck back behind the yellow curtains. But he wasn't looking. He didn't even know which room was hers. He kicked at acorns as he made his way to the house.
"What's he doing?"
Imogen asked from the bed where she sat embroidering flowers on a tablecloth.
"Knocking. He's knocking on the door."
"Right now?"
"Yeah, he's knocking right now."
They sat quietly, straining their ears to hear what happened in the next room. Leela held her breath at the sound of her Uncle Ernie's heavy feet plodding across the floor, and then the squeak of the door opening.
"They're shaking hands," Leela whispered. "How's my hair look?"
"Fine," Imogen told her.
"Rub your cheeks, though. Rub them hard to get some color."
"He's got flowers," Leela grinned.
"You're so lucky,"
Imogen whined. They sat there and waited to hear Uncle Ernie's voice call to Leela, but it never happened.
"Can you see anything?"
Imogen asked.
"He's still on the doorsteps. Wait.
He's leaving."
"What?"
"He's leaving."
Leela stood at the window, staring out, not trying to hide, hoping he would see her.
"Leela?"
Uncle Ernie called from the other room.
"Sir?"
she yelled back from the window. And when she did, Herman turned that way, looked and smiled, held up his hands. She grinned back at him and waved.
"Can you come in here for a minute? And you too, Imogen."
"Be right there,"
Leela called back, still facing Herman, who was walking on, turning back shyly to catch her eye from time to time. For the next hour, Uncle Ernie talked to the girls about courting. He said that Herman Langston could sit with Leela in church, if he was willing to go, but that there'd be no holding hands or touching of any kind. He said he'd already told Herman, and that once he'd proven his intentions for Leela, he might be able to accompany her on walks. Back in their bedroom, Imogen shrieked and giggled, and Leela blushed. It wasn't until later that she saw the pink azalea flowers lined up across the outside of the windowsill. The church and its classrooms were sacred places. Anything done there had to be done with the Spirit of God in mind. Once, when Mustard was little and church was dismissed, he hopped up off the pew and dashed outside. Bethany yanked Olin up, unhooked his belt before he even knew what was happening, and followed Mustard out onto the church stoop, where she blistered his backside in front of God and everybody, beat him until he wet his pants, just for running in the sanctuary. But in the fellowship hall, a rectangular building situated just behind the holy structure and surrounded by some scraggly pine trees, we could be ourselves. That's where we ate, when the whole church ate together. And that's where we had our youth retreats. A couple of times each year, the Fire and Brimstone young adults would host retreats for the Fire and Brimstone youth. On those occasions, all the children would bring blankets and pillows from their houses, and we'd praise God from twilight to daybreak if we felt like it.
studying scripture and singing songs and talking about everyday situations we faced that the adults didn't have to. David and Laura and Everett and Wanda and Ben Harback and some others who weren't yet shackled with children of their own would lead us in workshops about how to deal with the children on the bus who made fun of us, about how to know when we should tell our elders about unholy books we might be reading in school. We did fun things, like building a bonfire and destroying fashion magazines that somebody brought in from town just for the occasion. We had boiled peanuts and popcorn. We could talk about anything there. But that all happened later, after Grandpa Herman had given his sermon. Each time, Grandpa Herman would come in early. We'd all eat supper together, and then he'd lecture us while we sat at the wooden tables in front of him. Then he'd tell us to put our heads on the table, with every head bowed and every eye closed. Obediently, we'd follow his instructions. Then he'd ask us to raise our hands if we wanted to go to hell. He'd say, "Unless you've been saved and baptized in the precious blood of Jesus, each and every one of you will be going to hell." And then he'd tell us stories about how Jesus was coming back any day, probably within the next 5 years, and that we needed to be ready to greet him. He said that unless we'd been baptized, when the rapture happened, we'd be left behind. We'd wake up one day and call out, "Good morning," to our parents, and hear no reply. We'd look for them only to find their clothes left in the bed. He said that we'd run out of food, that big bugs would chase us around and sting us with their tails, and that though we might be sickened unto death, we couldn't die. He said we'd turn on the faucet in the bathroom and find only blood running out and would have nothing to drink. He said evil multitudes would come unto us and cut off our limbs, and that we wouldn't die. We'd sit there with no legs to run with and be stung and stung again by the beasts. And then he'd say, "But you don't have to be left behind. You can go straight to heaven with all of God's special children if you'll only open your hearts to Jesus, ask him for forgiveness, and welcome him into your hearts." And then he'd tell us to raise our hands again if we feared going to hell. Whoever raised their hand would be taken away to the church where Grandpa Herman would lead them to salvation. It happened the same way each time. The youngest children, invited to the youth retreats, would get saved right away. I'd raised my hand years earlier, but each time Grandpa Herman gave his after-the-rapture speech, I found it hard to catch my breath, hard to focus on God's love and not God's meanness and spite. I thought that really I wasn't saved at all. Grandpa Herman said that when you were truly saved, you felt like you could fly. But I never felt that way. Not about Jesus. And each time I knew that I mustn't really be saved, that I mustn't have opened my heart to him. I tried to figure out how you go about opening your heart. I tried not to think about being left behind, but in the nights, I kept slipping out of bed, checking the faucet to make sure it wasn't bleeding. On that occasion, it was John who went away with Grandpa Herman and came back testifying. We listened to Grandpa Herman's words coming out of John's 8-year-old mouth, and it made me feel sick all over. But then we broke into groups, and my group had just me and James and Pammy and Lori Evans and Joshua Langston, both older cousins who lived on the other side of the compound. David and Laura were our leaders, and they talked to us about teenage temptations, about how at our age we might be tempted to put on lipstick at school or smart-mouth a teacher in hopes of winning the affections of a boy or girl in our class. But they said it was important for us to wait until all those urges passed and until we had secured our hearts in Jesus. They said we would find a mate among God's special children if we didn't show off, and to come and talk to them if we had problems, because it hadn't been too long since they were our age.
Then they took questions, and Laurie asked about kissing. And I could see David and Laura both thinking that next time, Laurie would have to move up with the high schoolers that Everett and Wanda taught. Laura told her it was inappropriate, and Laurie shut up. Then Pammy asked if it was a sin if we accidentally let our knee socks fall down and a strange boy saw our legs. David told her it wasn't one, but that she should keep her socks up, and Laurie suggested that she could get rubber bands to hold them at the top. I didn't ask anything at all, but I worried that the next year when Pammy went to junior high and had to dress out for gym, she'd tell. It was almost midnight by the time Ben Harbach released the younger children. Then they began playing Red Rover, and he started the popcorn. And pretty soon, the older groups were let out too. Pammy and I made up a little cushiony bed, and then we sat up talking for a while. Some of the smaller children fell asleep, and across the room, Ben Harbach and David sat with some boys telling jokes, and Laurie Evans was in the corner talking to Wanda and Laura and pretending to be all grown up. Me and Pammy sat on our pallet and pulled a thick white blanket over us, up to the neck. Mustard came and stretched out beside Pammy, and she said, "You can't sleep here. You have to sleep with the boys." Mustard said, "I don't want to sleep here anyway. I want Nina to tell us a story." And then James sat down beside me, and Barley sat at the foot of the bed, and Mustard smacked Barley with his pillow, and Barley hit him back, and everybody laughed.
"Everything okay over there?"
Ben Harbach called.
"Yeah,"
Barley hollered.
"Nina's gonna tell us a story."